Grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway Piano Showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, with foods from around the world. Currently, they're featuring foods from Italy, including Italian cheeses like Parmigiano, Reggiano, oils, vinegar, Italian chocolates, cookies, and coffee, with taste samplings available. World Harvest Foods, 6th and University in Champaign, encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, we will go to the Focus Archives for a program from March. It's a conversation with Carlos Eyre. I'm talking about his memoir, Waiting for Snow in Havana. It's about his growing up in Cuba. As you listen, do remember the program is pre-recorded. We'll not take calls in this hour. We will, however, be back live as usual in hour number two. This program originally broadcast on March 26th. In the first hour of the show today, we'll be talking with Carlos Eyre, and we'll be talking about his memoir of growing up in Cuba in the 1950s. The book is titled Waiting for Snow in Havana, Confessions of a Cuban Boy. It won the National Book Award in 2000 and is now out in a paperback edition published by the Free Press. It's gotten a lot of well-deserved praise, and we're very pleased that he could be with us to talk this morning. Just a little bit more about him. He is professor of history and religious studies at Yale University. And he says this book, Waiting for Snow in Havana, was his first without footnotes. He's joining us by a high-quality here connection, an ISDN connection from Yale, and we're really pleased. Professor Eyre, thanks very much for giving us some of your time.
Oh, thanks for inviting me on the show. My pleasure.
One of the things I read about the book is that you said you wrote it as a novel and, in fact, that you wanted it published as a novel, but your publisher said, no, if it's substantially true, you can't do that. We have to call it what it is. Why did you approach it that way, and why even did you want it listed as fiction when, in fact, it is, as I think in one article I read, you said it's 98% true?
Well, that's right. I did say that. There are various reasons I wrote it as a novel and wanted it to appear as a novel. The most important reason was my own misunderstanding of the impact that a memoir can have. Being a historian, having written three other books that were read by maybe 500 people on Earth, I had always thought that the literary market was much greener on the fiction side of the hill. And I had a story to tell. I wanted to tell it as fiction because I thought it would have a greater impact. That was my own misunderstanding. I also knew, as a historian, that narrative can grip people at a much deeper level than any kind of reasoned analysis. Mm-hmm. So rather than sitting down and writing an essay or even an autobiography, what I did was to write a novel that is 98% true. Now, the funny thing is that in Germany, they have no trouble at all with the concept of a nonfiction novel. And in Germany, my book is being marketed as a novel because the Germans accept the concept that one can create a narrative that reads like a novel, yet is all true. I didn't want to become the focus of attention either. It's much easier to hide behind a mask, especially when you're confessing to doing things as a child that you would rather no one knew.
The thing that I think is true is that each chapter is a beautiful little essay that has a way of standing on its own and then becomes part of something bigger. But it does have the flavor of someone sitting down and saying to you, let me tell you a story about my childhood. So in that sense, it does have a feeling, a flavor of storytelling as if one person to another, not really so much as a – certainly doesn't feel like a piece of journalism.
Right. And it also was – constructed in such a way because every night I read to my children what I had written the previous night. I wrote this book in a 4-month period. I wrote every night in the summer of 2000. except for one day when I had surgery and the painkillers put me in another world. Every night I sat my three children down before they went to bed and read them what I had written the previous night. So in a way, this is a lot like the Tales of the Arabian Nights, where I kept going just so I could have something else to tell my kids the following day.
Hmm. One of the things that I always wonder about memoirs is who it is the writer thinks will read this. That is, who they're writing it for. Mm-hmm. And one can imagine a variety of intended audiences. Was this, in your mind, mostly a story, your story of your childhood for your own children?
It was to a large extent, but not entirely. I didn't have a specific audience in mind. But the greatest surprise for me since the book came out is how well received it has been among the Cuban exile community, and how they thank me for it. When in fact, when I was writing it, I had been isolated from the Cuban community for so long that the Cuban community could not even enter my mind. I wrote it primarily for an American audience or a non-Cuban audience. But yeah, my children figure prominently in the audience precisely because they were there listening to it every night. Mm. And my wife, too, read it every night. So I had my family audience and then some broader audience. And I narrate as if I'm speaking to another person. That was my intention.
Hmm. You were born in 1950?
Yep,
in
that's right.
Your father was a judge?
Yes, he was. He was a municipal judge, yeah.
So would you say that yours was a privileged upbringing?
By American standards, it was middle class in some respects, even lower middle class. For instance, we didn't have a hot water heater. We didn't have air conditioning in the tropics either. My father was an eccentric man who spent much of his income buying art objects. So therefore, we lived much more simply than someone with his income normally would have. Our house was probably the smallest house in the neighborhood. By American standards, it was a middle-class upbringing with definite perks that are hard to come by in the middle class in the United States, such as attending a very good private school that didn't cost very much, but nonetheless was a very fine private school. And rich neighbors, being in contact with kids at school whose parents were wealthy, put me in a different category. And one of our neighbors was kind enough to offer us rides to school every day in his chauffeur-driven Cadillac. Mm. So even though it wasn't our Cadillac or our chauffeur, I was living a very privileged life in that respect, mm. Yeah.
I think that there was at one point in the book where one of your schoolmates, someone makes a derisive reference to people riding in limousines, and you thought mm-hmm. to yourself, well, we don't have a limousine. My
That's
dad,
right.
He has his own car, and he takes the bus to work. And then you thought for a moment longer and thought, well, wait a minute. I do have this chauffeur that takes me and some of my buddies to school, home to have lunch, back to school again, and home. So then you realized, well, in a sense, maybe, yes, you do have that privilege.
Yeah, and it was a wake-up moment, even as a child. I had always thought, well, it's not ours. But then I realized, what makes me any different from the person who owns it? I ride in it every day to school. Mm-hmm. So that put me in a different category once the revolution triumphed, and anyone who enjoyed those privileges was a marked person.
Did you think, or how did you think, as you were growing up, about the difference between you and how it is you lived and those people who, and those children particularly, who were much, much poorer than you?
I think like any child, I asked my parents why this was so. I knew there was a difference. Havana had a very, very large middle class. Cuba in 1958 had the largest middle class in all of Latin America and the highest per capita income in all of Latin America. So I was living in a neighborhood where physically, just geographically, I was quite distant from those that were really, really poor. Every now and then, though, you couldn't help but run into poor people the way that you do here where I live now in New Haven, which is the seventh poorest city in the United States. And you can't help but run into poverty constantly. It did happen in Cuba. And as a child, I wondered why this was so. And I felt lucky. I felt very lucky, even as a seven-year-old or an eight-year-old. And then when things began to change, then I realized that maybe I hadn't been so lucky after all, having been born in a place where things could change so quickly.
Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest for anyone who might have tuned in. We're talking with Carlos Eyre. He's professor of history and religious studies at Yale and is the author of the book Waiting for Snow in Havana about his growing up in Cuba and won the National Book Award in nonfiction for 2003 and is now out in paperback. It's published by the Free Press. If you'd like to read it, you can head out to the bookstore and find it there. Questions, certainly, as always, are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Your father was an eccentric man, to say the least. And in the book, you write about the fact that he believed that in a past life, he talked about being in a past life, Louis the 16th, and said your mom was in a past life was Marie Antoinette. And I guess as reading the story, I'm never quite sure whether he thought that was a joke or whether he actually believed that. Do you?
Oh, no.
He actually did believe that.
He was dead serious about it. He was dead serious. And I have to laugh every time that a review praises me for writing in the vein of magical realism because there's nothing magical about it. It was the way it was. He was just like Shirley MacLaine, you know, who claims to remember her past lives. He didn't only remember Louis the 16th. He claimed to remember other previous lives. But a curious twist in his belief system is that he claimed he could identify other people from previous lives, too. In his cosmos, everyone seems to have been reborn together in different places at different times, but sort of going through life together. Hence, you know, almost my entire family was the French royal family. It irritated me as a child to have him say that because it didn't make sense to me, even as a kid. And then at school, we were not taught reincarnation. I knew that there was something quite odd about it, and I didn't hear any of my friends' parents claiming past lives either. So it sort of put my dad in a category all his own.
Did he talk about this outside of the family, or was this just something that was discussed among family members?
Well, he had friends who had similar beliefs. Ironically enough, these beliefs were brought to Cuba by American missionaries from the American Theosophical Society, who established a mission in Cuba just shortly after the Spanish-American War and made many converts among the middle class. And I find it somewhat ironic that this is the work of American missionaries. And now most Americans, when they read my book, think I'm making all this up.
How old were you when the revolution happened?
Well, Fidel's revolution began in 1956, so I was five when it began. And he triumphed. He took over and eliminated all the other revolutionaries because there were many, many different groups fighting against Batista. He just happened to eliminate all the others once Batista had fled. This happened on New Year's Day, 1959. I had just turned eight a month before, at the end of November. So I was eight when the real change took place. Mm-hmm. But between 56 and 59, there was always some kind of violence on the streets in Havana, sometimes quite close to us. Every night I remember going to sleep to the sound of gunfire and bombs going off in the distance. I'm sure it wasn't every night, but that's how I remember it. It was sort of a lullaby. Mm-hmm. Off in the distance.
I'm sure you got from your parents the sense that this was a very dangerous time, and your father, because of his position, because of the fact that he was a judge, would have certainly been a target. What was your sense of what it was that was happening?
My sense of what happening was that what was happening was at first one of relief, because even as a child, I didn't like Batista and his government and the way that he ruled, especially when I learned that sometimes the people who were imprisoned were tortured. That disturbed me immensely as a child, and I wanted Batista to leave. So at first I was really happy and relieved that it was over. It was only a matter of months, though, until I realized that the new government that had come into power was even more cruel and more vicious in its attempt to control everybody. I thought changes were necessary, but I didn't like the changes that took place, even as a child. But of course, from a very childish perspective, some movies started to be rated, and children were not allowed to come in and see the movies, even movies as innocent as 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. That was my first experience with censorship. I was told I couldn't go in because I was a minor. And as my first brush with censorship and someone trying to tell me what I could or could not do. And it left a deep imprint on me. From that day, it was a long series of events, one after the other, that convinced me that what was happening was not good at all. And then people started leaving, and people started being arrested. And before long, my own family members began to be arrested, imprisoned, and tortured. So I, by 1961, hated what was going on and was desperate for it to change or for me to leave. So when my parents said, we're going to send you to the United States, it didn't come as a great shock to me. And in many ways, it came as a relief.
This was the event that's, I don't know how many people will remember this, it was called Operation Pedro Pan. 14,000 children ended up being airlifted out of Cuba and taken to the United States. And you and your older brother were among them. You lived in the United States, just the two of you, before your mother could manage to get out. I think it was 3 years, and your father never did leave. He stayed in Cuba, apparently because he thought, in part, that the revolution would blow over and that the family could be reunited again. Tell me about that, about the experience of being put on the plane and flown out of Cuba.
The airlift, in many ways, was a panic, but it was a very well-organized panic. And anyone who did this, anyone who put their kids on the KLM flights to Florida, did it thinking that they'd be reunited in a matter of months. The reason the children got out so quickly, because this is an airlift that lasted only from 1960 to 1962. Children didn't need security clearances from the State Department, so children could get visa waivers. And parents thought their children were about to be taken away from them, because, in fact, children were being taken away from parents to send the teenagers, especially, sent out to the countryside to perform slave labor. And the Cuban Constitution had been changed to read that the state was the ultimate guardian of all children on the island, not the parents. So parents panicked. Once the kids arrived in the U.S., the parents then applied for visas, and it would usually take anywhere from 3 to 5 months, sometimes longer, for the parents to get visas and join their children in the United States. But what went wrong was the October missile crisis of 1962. A result of the missile crisis was that Cuba slammed the door shut and wouldn't let anyone leave the island, including the parents of over 10,000 of the children, including my parents. And they left the door firmly sealed for quite a long time. A great shock to those of us that expected to be reunited in just a matter of months. But there were camps in South Florida that took us in, and the camps were processing centers, basically. We would stay in the camps until they found some other place for us to go, a foster home, an orphanage, and in many cases, sadly, reformatories. Any place they could put us, they'd send us there. And we were scattered throughout the 50 states. Well, I haven't yet met anyone who went to Alaska or Hawaii, but at least the continental United States, there were some that ended up in Idaho and Montana, in Colorado, all sorts of places. I ended up eventually in Bloomington, Illinois. So I lived there for 2 years with my uncle. An uncle of mine eventually came to the U.S. just before the door slammed shut and was relocated to Bloomington. And my brother and I, after bouncing around a number of foster homes for a year and a half, ended up living with him in Bloomington for 2 years until my mom arrived. And we joined her in Chicago. She was sent to Chicago because she had no English and no job skills. She had just been a housewife all her life. And at that time, it was fairly easy to get a job as an assembler in Chicago because there were so many factories. So they sent her there, and we met up with her there 3.5 years after we had left Cuba.
The title, I think, refers in part to your childhood desire to have snow at Christmas time. But it also has to suggest, I think, at least in my mind, the idea of someone hoping for something that they should know in their heart of hearts just isn't going to happen. And I wonder if you could talk about that and what waiting for snow in Havana means.
Sure. It has various levels. Every time I talk about it, I uncover some other level. but the main reason that I chose the title is that in the book I speak about how it was that as a child I felt we Cubans were being cheated out of something because we didn't have snow. All of our Christmas cards Cubans sent to one another, had snow scenes on them. And I began to associate as a very, very small child snow with Santa Claus and presents, goodness. And then when I was about 8 years old, I was looking at a map of the world, and I realized that all the countries that made things, all the countries that made the televisions and the cars and the bicycles and everything else had snow, but we didn't. And that was my awakening to the fact that I lived in a place that was second place, second rank, perhaps lower than second rank from other places in the world. And in my mind, I began to associate snow with goodness, purity. And as an 8-year-old, I imagined that in countries where it snowed, everyone was happy all the time. And there were very few problems. At another level, as I matured, up to the time that I left, I began to realize that there were many things that were not going to change in my lifetime. Not only was it not going to snow, but I was convinced by the time I left Cuba that it was a place that would never have good government, a place where people would always be tortured, where human rights would be violated. And, well, it has proven true in my lifetime anyway, up to now. It didn't have to be that way, but having lived in a place where a revolution was a constant thing since the time I was a small boy, I came to think that my country was bedeviled by all these problems because it was in the tropics and that somehow warm weather made you be this way. Of course, now I know differently, especially after 2 years of living in Minnesota.
People in Minnesota aren't happy in January?
Oh, no, not all of them. Many of them are, but not necessarily because of the snow.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in how some of the people who have reviewed the book make it sound a bit like Caribbean travel writing. And while I think it's a beautiful book, it's also, it seems to me, a sad book. There's a fundamental note of sadness that I think pervades the whole thing. And I guess I wonder how you think about that, particularly the balancing the what seem to be pleasant childhood memories of a really a kind of a glowing, sun-drenched childhood. You know, I think about you're right in the beginning of the book talking about what sunsets are like, you know, about having that kind of image, balancing that all the good stuff against the unhappiness and the sadness and this sort of this fundamental sense that something is missing that's never quite going to be restored.
Yeah, well, the book is about loss, basically, and how to cope with loss and learning and how it is that at least I learned that every loss has gains that come along with it, that nothing is an undiluted loss, even the loss of a loved one. The past remains a world of its own. And as long as you have your memory and as long as these memories are crisp and clear, you never really lose the past, but you have this longing for it, especially in my case and the case of almost all Cubans my age who left as children. We cannot revisit physically our childhood. We can't go back to the houses where we grew up in. We can't walk the streets in the neighborhoods where we lived in. And the past becomes sort of encased as very much as an object inside a paperweight, you know, that you see floating inside the glass. It's there, but you can't get to it. And, of course, everyone loses their childhood. Absolutely everyone on earth loses their childhood, and they can't go back to it. But in the case of all the kids who left Cuba under the same circumstances as my brother and myself, it was a very abrupt end. Literally, overnight, we lost our childhood. So there is that sense of longing. But there's also a sense of hope. I would say that something like two-thirds or three-quarters of the mail that I receive, and I receive a lot of mail, people say, I read your book, and it made me laugh, and it made me cry. It's gotten to the point now where my wife says, did you get another one of those I laughed and I cried letters? I said, yes. Oh, it's okay. That's exactly the reaction I wanted to elicit from readers. This is how life is. It doesn't matter if you live through a revolution or not. Everyone's life has some sadness in it and a lot of loss. And all human beings on earth have to learn how to cope with this. A revolution makes it more intense, but I don't care where anyone lives or how rich they are. Everyone has to face up to the fact that life is a series of pluses and minuses, and one has to somehow go with the pluses rather than the minuses.
You haven't been back, not since you left.
No. I always thought it was too dangerous to go back. They could drum up charges against you. If I were to go to Cuba, they would not accept my American citizenship. As a matter of fact, the minute you land there, if you're an American citizen who was born in Cuba, they take away your American passport and hold it hostage until the day that you leave. And instead, they make you pay some exorbitant amount, like $200, for a Cuban passport. I have met people my age who went back in the 80s and got in trouble. One man in particular I met just 2 months ago went with his mother and sister in the late 80s. The minute he stepped off the plane, they threw him in prison and accused him of espionage. They had photos of him standing outside the United Nations in New York protesting against the Castro regime. They had the photos, and they knew who he was. And the minute he stepped off the plane, they arrested him. Now I can't go back because my book is on the Index of Forbidden Books. And they're actually searching luggage and confiscating any copies that they can find.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Carlos Eyre. He's professor of history and of religious studies at Yale University, where he got his PhD. and is the author of a memoir, Waiting for Snow in Havana. And it is out in paperback now. It's published by Free Press. Won the National Book Award in 2003 for nonfiction writing. And you might want to take a look at it. And questions, of course, do are welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, actually, this program is from the Focus 580 archives. It means we're not taking calls this morning. We'll resume in just a moment. First, we need to pause for this, as it's the first Tuesday of the month. This is a test of the emergency alert system.
This message was instituted by the Illinois Emergency Management Agency. This station is participating in a required monthly test of the Illinois Emergency Alert System. This system was developed to provide information to the public during emergencies. This was a test.
Now, we'll go back to this morning's archive edition of Focus 580. Again, remember, no calls in this first hour. A conversation with Carlos Ayer, Waiting for Snow in Havana, his memoir, the show, first broadcast March 26th. Why do you think your father decided to stay? I'm assuming that there would have been a point where he could have left.
Yeah, it was too late, though. But one thing that I always keep in mind is I never, ever got to speak to my father as an adult. The last real conversation I had with him was the day I left when I was 11. He died in 1976. Up to that time, calls to Cuba were limited to 3 minutes, and there was always someone listening at the other end. Once, for instance, when my mom said to my dad, "I miss you so much," someone at the other end started laughing. So you had to be very careful what you said, and you only had 3 minutes. So I never got to ask my dad point blank, what are you doing? Why are you staying there? Why don't you come and join us? I got hints in letters. He always kept saying, "This is going to change. You'll see. We'll be together soon. This can't last this long. This can't last too long." But then he developed heart disease and started to make arrangements to leave. But he died of a heart attack before he could leave, suddenly. That was that. That was the end of his effort to join us.
Your father's name is not Ayer. That's your mother's family's name.
That's right.
Why did you take your mother's family's name and not your father's?
Well, again, there are many reasons for that, and it's a very thick cultural context. As you probably know, most Hispanics use both family surnames. Hmm. I grew up having two surnames. The minute I landed in the United States, I was very, very miffed. I was told no per customer. You can only have one last name. So I went from being Carlos Nieto Ayre to being Carlos Nieto. And it annoyed me greatly. I also, in the 1970s, after my father died, came to the realization that it was my mother who had shouldered most of the burden of trying to join us, being here for us, even though there was not much she could do for my brother and me when she arrived. She tried. And my father had not. So I decided to use her name. I never got rid of Nieto. I still have it as a middle initial. And as a matter of fact, in all my scholarly writing, people know me as Carlos M. N. Ayer. The Free Press didn't want me to use middle initials, so I said fine. But there's also a very, very, very old Spanish custom which fell into disuse up to the 18th century in Hispanic cultures. Individuals chose which of the two surnames to pass on to their children. And in the case of my father's family in the 17th century, the name Nieto, surname, was passed on through someone's mother. Otherwise, our name would have been Sanchez. So putting all these things together and also not being able to abide anyone calling me Nito. I thought, Maybe it's even more respectful of the name Nieto just to leave it as an initial than have someone call you Nito all the time. Yeah. In Bloomington, everyone knew me as Charlie Nito or Chuck Nito.
Chuck Nito.
Yeah. Yep, quite a difference. As soon as I got to Chicago, I went back to being Carlos rather than Charlie or Chuck.
I guess the reason I ask is just I was wondering or want to make sure that if people somehow get this idea that it was a disavowing of your dad that it wasn't anything like that.
Right. No, it wasn't. Although I guess in part it's very easy for people to make that assumption, and I know I live with that constantly because people ask, you know, what's the deal here?
Yeah.
And I just got a letter, an email this morning from someone who asked, aren't you being disrespectful to your dad for changing your name? So I have to write to him and say, well, I don't think so.
We have caller, and would welcome others. We do have about 20 minutes left in this part of the show. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. The caller is in Urbana on line 1. Hello.
Yeah. Oh, hello. Hi. Uh-huh. Thank you for being on the show, and I really look forward to reading your book. I'm a Cuban-American, too, and I came in mid-60s. And we had the same situation with the name, so I really relate there. And for me, the middle initial, you know, my mother's maiden name is very important. If it's left out, it's like, you know, we had to switch the names around with the father keeping being the main name, and then we put it, or my mother's name as a middle initial. And whenever people leave it out, it's like, oh, it's like a piece of my identity being stripped out. But I just want to ask a question about, you know, the Cuban situation is very complex, and I think you kind of touched earlier. In that, you know, change was needed. And the revolution in the beginning under Castro, the hope was different than what culminated in the end. And that's what a lot of people, you know, the majority of the Cubans did support the revolution, but when it changed and, the relations with Soviet Union, it really changed the flavor of the revolution. And it was no longer just one of the Cuban people. But beyond that, I'm just wondering about, there are a lot of questions I want to ask you, but I was just wondering how you deal with those kinds of complexities of the Cuban history, and also within your own family, just the pain that I hear, the feelings of loss, not knowing, you know, you remember certain things and you may not remember other things, and obviously your own childhood was very painful leaving your parents at such a young age with your brother. And I'm just wondering how you deal with those kinds of issues.
Well, in the book, I deal with it through narrative. I don't try to analyze things. I just simply state what I lived through. And my view of things. Several reviewers have remarked that it's almost like saying it's too bad he came from that family. It would have been such a much better story if he had been poorer. As if I don't have a right to complain because we had more than some other Cubans. Mm-hmm. I try to focus on the complexity of things through narrative. I try to focus through the disappointment, or what in the book I point out is one of the most beautiful Spanish words, desengaño, that everyone went through.
Right.
Because almost every time that I make a public appearance now, I get a question where I have to clarify. No, Fidel was not the only answer to Batista. Many of the men who landed at the Bay of Pigs invasion had fought against Batista. Mm-hmm. Many of them had actually fought side by side with Fidel. And we're betrayed, and we're trying to reclaim the revolution. But those complexities are often lost on anyone who doesn't understand the intricacies of Cuban history in the 20th century.
Right.
They're sometimes lost on me because as a professional historian who doesn't deal with Cuba, I deal with Europe in the years 1400 to 1700. I know as a professional historian, there are many things that I should find out details before I speak about them. That's another reason. And in the book, the only fact I checked in writing this book was how many men landed at the Bay of Pigs.
Mm.
I wanted to have that number, but it's the only fact I looked up. Everything else I say in there was my impression. And a couple of writers, readers have written in to correct some of my facts. Mm-hmm. But they're all minor points, very minor points.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thanks.
Other people who are listening, you have questions, you can call 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think some people would look at you and your experience and say, here is a man who is the embodiment of one of our cherished, most cherished beliefs. They might actually use the term myth, that a person can come here to this country with little or nothing and can become a great success, can go on to get a PhD at Yale and become a college professor and win the National Book Award. I guess I wonder how you think about that.
I think this is a marvelous country and a unique place on earth. And it is true. You can end up as I did, but many don't. It's not a guarantee for everyone who comes to this country that they might end up successful. In my case, luck had a lot to do with it, just sheer luck. When we moved to Chicago, if we had moved into a neighborhood that was 10 blocks south of where we ended up, I would have gone to a terrible high school instead of going to a good high school. And what might have happened to me if I had gone to the awful high school, I don't want to know. But we almost moved there. And also the generosity of the American people, the generosity with which I witness all the time now from this end in higher education, the fact that there are so many scholarships, the fact that an education in this country is really never denied to anyone. Sure, you have to work hard and you have to make sacrifices, but no one is denied an education if they want it in this country. And quite often the neediest have even a better opportunity than those who are not so needy, because there are so many fellowships and scholarships. I didn't have to pay any college tuition. I didn't have to pay any graduate school tuition. I had to take out a lot of loans, which I paid until 3 years ago. But no one stopped me. No one said, you can't do this. I picked one of the most impractical professions on earth, and I managed to luck out, too, to get a job and then get another good job and end up here. It took hard work, but it also has a certain amount of luck involved.
You were paying college loans until you were 50?
Yes. Yes. I got into a particularly bad loan I'd rather not discuss with these people. If I start to give you the details, everyone will think I'm probably the stupidest person on earth for having signed on the dotted line. Yeah, I paid a percentage of my income. I ended up paying something like 3,000% interest when all was said and done. Hmm.
Well, it's paid off. Maybe that's all.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's behind me now, yeah.
Let's talk. We have somebody here calling on a mobile phone, a cell phone, line one. Hello.
Yes, hi. Hope you can hear me in the middle of the monsoon season here in central Illinois, calling from the car. But very interesting story, fascinating. I'm 48 years old and actually grew up on the south side of Chicago, I think pretty close to the time you were down there. So it was interesting to hear you talk. My question, listening to you talk about Castro and the revolution, I can remember going through the late 60s and the 70s and the young people kind of putting their arms around Che at that point, making him a hero and the posters of him and so on and so forth, the kind of the counterculture. From your perspective, was he quite the hero that... we made him out to be, or was he in fact part and parcel of the whole Fidel regime there?
This annoys me to no end every time I see Che's face on a T-shirt, because Che was a cold-blooded killer, a ruthless, ruthless man who put his ideology before any other human being. Anyone got in his way, that was it. He was competition for Fidel, though. Fidel has never liked having a number two person. And it's one of the reasons that Che ended up in Bolivia, was that Fidel was very glad to get rid of him. But he was not a good person by any definition of the term. Most of the people who wear his face on a T-shirt would probably, if they lived under Che's rule, be in prison. That's the great irony.
Well, it's very refreshing to hear you talk about that. And I'm just wondering, from your point of view, how do you think all of that, I mean, it was quite prevalent, if you remember in the 70s, and do you just think he was something that was kind of plucked out of the sky and the counterculture kind of put their arms around it? Or I mean, was there any, how do you think that all came to be like that?
Well, it came to be because, especially in the 60s and early 70s, the ideology, which was at the heart of the Cuban Revolution, was the ideology that most of the young people, especially the better educated people in the United States, embraced, which was total equality, sharing of the goods, trying to wipe out poverty, trying to help the underprivileged, trying to sort of level out society so that everyone would be on the same level. That was the aim of the revolution, but it was never achieved. That's the sad part. And the little that was achieved through such cruelty that's what most Americans and Europeans and even Latin Americans still don't understand. I was very, very happy to see in a catalog that my teenage son received, they were selling T-shirts, and the Che Guevara T-shirt was right in between one for Homer Simpson and another one for Megadeth. And
well,
I thought, this is the ultimate. This is where Che belongs, next to Homer Simpson, basically.
Everything comes around full circle. I'm not familiar with the story, but can you tell me the story behind how he died?
He went to Bolivia to incite revolution in Bolivia and ended up getting caught by the Bolivian army with help from the CIA, and he was killed. And actually, the most famous photo of Che, the one you see on T-shirts and mugs and so on, this is when he was in Bolivia, not from Cuba.
I see. All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Thank
you.
Let's go
to another caller here, someone in southeastern Illinois on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes, I was curious. You said that most of your father's income went into the art objects. I just wondered what happened to the art objects.
I don't know. When you left Cuba, you had to leave absolutely everything behind. I left with two changes of clothing. That's all you were allowed to take out. They actually strip searched you to make sure you weren't taking out any valuables. When my father died, he was in the process of actually trying to establish a museum. But I don't know what happened after he died. I have no idea. All of it is gone. In Cuba, you can't have any. You don't have any property. Everything belongs to, quote unquote, the people.
So they left them with him until his death. Then, I mean, they didn't confiscate them immediately.
No. Usually, they wouldn't come in and confiscate what you had inside the house that you were living. They could come and take your house away and give you another one if they thought that your house was too big for you. But no, they generally didn't come and take things away from you right under your feet. But when you left, you had to leave absolutely everything behind.
Thank you.
And they inventoried everything, too, to make sure that everything was there on the day that you left.
We have about 7-8 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, talking with Carlos Eyre about his book, Waiting for Snow in Havana, Confessions of a Cuban Boy, about his growing up in Cuba in the 50s, about how he came to the United States, won the National Book Award last year. It's now available in a paperback published by Free Press. I wonder how you would react to what I'm sure would be the position of the Cuban government and perhaps some of its supporters, that if Cubans now are worse off than they were before Castro, it is not his fault. It's not fault of socialism. It's basically because a state of war exists between it's not official, but a state of war exists between mm-hmm. Cuba and the United States, and it's because of persecution, essentially by the United States, that Cubans are poor today.
I had to laugh when I went to speak at the University of Wisconsin. I was supposed to be sponsored by some Latin American council or something, but they pulled away the sponsorship and said that they couldn't sponsor me because I was coming to represent the oppression of the Cuban people by the exile community. And I laughed and laughed at that one. The claim being made by Castro and people who don't know any better that the embargo has caused this is a bold-faced lie. And it's a stupid lie, too, which is very easy to uncover. Cuba can trade with the rest of the world. Cuba can get whatever goods it wants from the rest of the world. And the United States is only one of several countries in the world that produces goods. The problem is that the economy in Cuba is totally centralized and totally under the control of the government. There is no room for private enterprise whatsoever. And this is what has caused the country to decline as precipitously as it has. This is why there's no paint for the buildings. This is why there are no timbers, why there are no steel rods. This is why all the buildings are falling down and why people are starving to death very slowly, is that everything is very tightly controlled in Cuba. So therefore, the economy has collapsed. And they can't trade with the rest of the world because they have crashed their own economy, not because of the embargo. You don't have to take an economics course to figure this one out. Canada has been trading with Cuba nonstop since 1959. Cuba had access to all the same goods that Canadians have, but the government there chose to sort of stifle and strangle any initiative that is not part of the central planning. And that creates chaos. It creates instability. And when something goes wrong, it goes wrong on a very large scale because most of the programs focus on creating one type of income. Like, for instance, for many, many years, Fidel was hell-bent on having these massive amounts of sugar produced and that this was going to get the economy going. But, of course, failure after failure just drove the sugar economy of Cuba further down the tubes. And without help from the Soviet Union after 1991, forget it. There's no way that they could pick up the pieces.
Did you ever, I know I've read and you've talked about the fact that you lived in Bloomington, Illinois, and you lived in Chicago, and once you got into your academic career, you were in Minnesota, and now you're in, is it New Haven? Where
New Haven, yes. Is? Yeah.
And that in a lot of those places, there weren't a lot of other Cubans, so maybe you didn't have an opportunity to really get into any sort of local Cuban community. I guess I wonder, did you ever... And we're coming down here. I don't have a whole lot of time, but did you ever think about involving yourself in politics on that issue? That is the relationship between Cuba and the United States.
No, not really. What happened to me is very common among people my age, who were scattered, who were taken out of the South Florida Cuban community. I thought what had happened to me was more or less like a bad accident. I had to accept it and move on and do something else. The sweetest irony of all is that, of course, I buried all this. I thought I had put it behind me, but I hadn't. It came bubbling up when I wrote this book.